Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. Okay, so as promised in our last published JREP session, we've got a special treat for you today. Byron Nagy, hope I'm pronouncing your last name right, Byron, whose family have relocated from Tokyo to the Japanese countryside, where they've been working on an amazing project for the past year or more. And Byron's our guest on the show today. They've got an organic farm, a beautiful old farmhouse that they've renovated into a farm stay lodging accommodation. And they're now almost done with the construction of the new home nearby, which has been built using a unique combination of traditional techniques and materials alongside modern conveniences and facilities. Truly remarkable and extremely challenging project that we're going to hear all about, as well as see. He's given us a full hands-on tour of the house as well. So enjoy the ride, and I'll see you again on the other side.
Go.
All right, Japan Real Estate Experts panel back in session. And as we have promised you last week, well, it wasn't last week, but you're going to be hearing it last week. we have a special guest session today. So we're not going to do self-introductions today. We're going to immediately dive into Byron's repertoire and history and apparently very exciting things that he's been up to. So Byron, the stage is yours. Who are you? What are you doing in Japan? When did you come to Japan?
So I've been in Japan now about 20 years. I came from the U.S., from the East Coast, New York, New Jersey area. And my family is from Europe, but I grew up in the city in the United States. And I mean, I came to Japan as a student initially, and then I worked in like a white collar profession in Tokyo for the first 10 years or so. And then it was after the earthquake and the Fukushima nuclear disaster and all that, that my wife at the time, or my girlfriend at the time, and now she's my wife, We were both kind of questioning the consumer lifestyle that we were living in Tokyo, and just in terms of like food security and energy security, we had this desire to kind of be more in control of like the environment that we are in and the food and the energy that we consume, and kind of like house building and construction was an extension of that. You know, we looked at contemporary, construction methods in Japan after we had a child and we were thinking about building a house here. And I was just kind of, you know, very dissatisfied with the idea of building something that would be turned, you know, by the time you pay off a loan, the value of the building would be nothing. And, had been looking at the traditional Japanese construction techniques and the traditional like carpentry techniques. And it was something that I always had like a lot of respect for, but I felt like there were so many disconnects between that and what like a modern comfortable lifestyle should be, at least in terms of how I saw it. So we kind of set off on our own house building adventure here. I mean, you can see the house behind me. It's in a process of construction, but we're kind of on the last stages of it now. We really kind of explored a lot of different avenues in terms of mixing traditional Japanese techniques with other more modern natural building techniques and passive solar design, and you know, like high standards in terms of insulation and you know, basically building performance and longevity.
That's a recurring topic on our sessions as well. The lack of
So over the last couple of years, more recently, I mean, in addition to the house that you know, it's been kind of like a dream house project where I've started 5-6 years ago learning how to drive an excavator and then cutting the trees down from the mountain myself and then doing all the rock work and learning the process behind
the foundation. The rock story. I love the rock story.
All the concrete and then doing all the traditional Japanese timber frame construction and then employing a lot of other like natural building earth, like natural plastering and earthen wall techniques, like earthen floor, like a natural adobe floor and stuff. And the house itself is made using like light straw clay infill, which is a technique where you use like a mix of straw that's mixed with a coating of clay to kind of bind it together, and then that's pushed into a formwork to form like a thick insulative layer around the exterior of the house. And it's 30 centimeters thick. So it's very similar to a straw bale construction, except that you're not building with blocks. You're mixing a material and then compacting it inside like a matrix inside the walls. We're kind of on the final stages of building this house, but now I'm kind of turning my sights to other real estate and natural building potential projects here in Japan. Aside from the house, we also renovated a 150-year-old Japanese farmhouse, like a kominka, and we operate that as Yokomura Eco Lodge, which is like a farm-to-table bed and breakfast where we have people come and they also come up to the farm and kind of do like a whole farm-to-table type experience when they can come. And that house as well, we've kind of employed a bunch of, we've done something called furu tatami koho in Japanese, which is using old tatami mats. Well, old in the sense that they're used, but not rotting tatami mats. Yeah. The more modern tatami mats are actually made with styrofoam cores. And basically we get that material for free from old tatami stores in the area that we have a relationship with, and we use that as insulation material around the whole exterior of the house. So we used like 150 tatami mats, and then there's like Tyvek on the outside of that, so the whole house is insulated with tatami, and it performs surprisingly well.
So you're saying, because my image, and I must be very uneducated on this, but you're saying, when I hear you know, eco living or off the grid or you know, natural living style, I'm thinking I'm going to be lacking all of the modern conveniences that I seek usually. But you're saying you actually got into that because you wanted to get those in. So how do the two gel together?
Yeah, I mean, I think that traditionally a lot of Japanese houses, especially when you look at how people lived back in the day, I mean, they had like a open fire inside their house. And that means they needed good air ventilation. And Japan's also a very humid climate. So, you know, being able to ventilate in the summertime is great, but it sucks when it's cold and, you know, you need to use space heaters and you're losing all that heat to the environment around you. So, I mean, I kind of wanted to thin the line, thread the fine line or the thread the needle rather, between, you know, the aesthetics that I appreciate and the traditional techniques that I appreciate about Japanese construction, because clay as a building material is great because it lets vapor pass through it, right? That's the big problem with using non-organic materials in houses, that you get moisture stuck because of non-vapor permeable materials like insulation, and then moisture gets built up in the house and you start getting mold problems over time. Like clay as a material is great in the sense that, you know, you can avoid all that, but it's also very heavy and very labor intensive, as Matt can attest to. And it's
very heavy.
it's not used in contemporary construction for very, very obvious reasons, that mostly being that labor is expensive and it's not like a conducive to, quick building.
Yeah. And I mean, that's part of what has always impressed me so much about what Byron is doing, is just like, threading the needle. And Ziv, to go back to your point about, when you hear about off-the-grid living, it's cavemen and mountain people and hermits and, that guy who was living in a cave for like 30 years until they found him recently and doesn't know how to wear clothes. That's like the legend of it, right? Whereas the modern 2020 or 21st century or whatever version is like, okay, let's be practical about things. What can we do that, okay, maybe like with clay and whatnot, okay, that takes time, labor intensive, but if it's a passion project or it's something that you take on your own, and especially if your expectations are in alignment with the reality of doing something like that, then it's feasible in the sense that you're not going to be disappointed in sort of the progress that you make, however slow or quickly that is. Additionally, with things like Wi-Fi, right? If you want to be a mountaintop hermit, all right, cool. You probably don't need Wi-Fi there or whatever, but if you want to be off the grid in a modern sense, it's not necessarily completely separated from society. It's being able to balance, what are the necessary sort of accoutrements and, tools and whatnot, resources that you need to be quote unquote successful, whatever that means in the modern age, while also being in tune with nature to the extent that, again, is kind of reasonable.
That right? was actually going to be my next question, because, How are you dealing with the infra? Where exactly in Japan are you, Byron?
We're on the border of Yamanashi and Kanagawa Prefecture. So the house is technically in Kanagawa in a town called Fujino, which is technically part of Sagamihara City, but it's just off the Chuo-do, past Sakumiko before you get to Otsuki.
How are you there with infrastructure? So is that part of the plan? Or do you have are you on water, city gas, Wi-Fi, internet?
So the house is not complete yet, but when it is, there's no municipal water where we are. The water is managed by the local. I'm actually in a small village of nine houses. And about 12 years ago, five of those nine houses burned down. And everybody moved out of the village except for two houses that are still occupied by people who are in their 70s.
Wow.
So when I came and I saw this place, I was like, wow, this is incredible. There's this incredible infrastructure that goes back hundreds of years in terms of like the agriculture and the terraced fields and the plots where the houses used to be, that I felt like this place really has a potential to be that kind of like a model for like a sustainable revitalization of the Japanese countryside.
Yeah. Yep, exactly.
That was kind of like the vision that I had when I came out here and I started this project. And I mean, over the years, I've been, kind of tempered by reality in the sense that like, it's hard to get like local cooperation sometimes. Building relationships takes time. And, I'm a bit impatient. I just want, I have a vision for what could be here. And I see such a wasted opportunity that I kind of just want to make something happen. So it's frustrating in that sense. But it's an incredible spot. And that's why we chose the location. We're not on municipal water. We get the water as just managed by this locality of the five, six houses. They have like a local spring and it's gravity fed from across the valley down across the river to a cistern that feeds all the houses. But half the houses burned down, so right now they have a lot of water in the tank. And then in terms of the other energy, and it's no problem with electricity. The plan is to have an off-grid photovoltaic system. I mean, I have the batteries and charge controller and panels set up and just on maintenance mode, but we haven't attached it to the house yet. And I'll probably try to implement like the battery system as a backup or as a normal use system. And then if we don't have enough charge in the batteries, we can switch over to Toden if necessary. And then gas, I'm not 100% certain if I'm going to implement gas in the house. Right now at the guest house, we have a wood-fired bathtub, and it might be a tangent.
Last time, can I jump in on that for a second?
Wood-fired.
Last time I was there, this is after I moved out of the city, so like I thought that I kind of knew how to, you know, conduct myself. But I went to go use the wood-fired bath, right? And like, it's wood fired. It's hot as shit. And like basically boiling. And so I'm standing there like dipping my toe in it, being like, ah, well, like, whoa, how, what? Like, how am I supposed to get into this? And of course I see that there is a spigot with a nozzle on it. And I'm just not putting two and two together of like, oh, wait, I'm supposed to turn the cold water on to manage the hotness of the boiling water. Did not click at all. I think I stood in that tub for like 20 seconds or something. And I was just like, oh, I'm out. Like, forget this. I'm done.
I was going to say, is that also the cause for like those five other houses burning down?
No. That's a different...
So, Byron, that was... pretty big project, right?
About the wood-fired bath is that, you know, it's not something that we realized until we started living like that, having the wood-fired bath, that, you know, we are in such a rush for convenience in our modern lifestyle that everything, whether it's about the bath or the lights or anything like building a new house, is all about how can we make everything faster and more convenient and at our fingertips and just at the press of a button, you know, get the lights on, get everything dimmed. And what I found since using this bath over the last couple of years is that it's almost like planned inconvenience. The time that you away from yourself to stop what you're doing and light the fire and the smoke. And that feeling of just like sitting in the bath, you know, it's a bit corny, but like it's very meditative, and it really kind of gives you a different perspective that like, what are we in such a rush for, you know? And that's kind of where the whole house build thing, with my personal house that I'm building out here, that's over the past of like 4 or 5 years, how that got started, that I was kind of in it for trying to, number one, learn the techniques and the processes so I could maybe, you know, put that knowledge to use somehow. And number two, I just wanted something that meant something by not something that was mass produced and built in like a second, but I wanted something that had memories and value behind it, and kind of was looking for that deeper meaning, especially after coming away from my Tokyo consumer lifestyle at the time. So yeah, that's kind of what started the whole process.
Byron. I'm gonna jump in here. I've been very quiet. Byron, you may not know me, but I am really into the short-term rental mm-hmm. business. And I see that you've got a short-term rental component to your business there. This storytelling and this, you know, this history is extremely compelling, and it's very authentic. Are you able to sort of, you know, how are you leveraging that to, you know, either through social media to actually find people who want what you've, like, who want to find what you've got and bottle it and enjoy it for themselves?
I know what you mean. I you know, my background before I started the guest house out here, I was running Airbnbs in Tokyo. I had 3 or 4 units that I was renting and then subletting out. And then obviously after the rules and the regulations changed, we had to kind of shut down the business in Tokyo. And then with the guest house out here, we got all the licensing and everything sorted so that we're operating as a ryokan technically. We have a noka minpaku, which is not minpaku, but rather like a farm stay that right. we're offering.
Yeah.
And you know, when we started it, I had very kind of lofty ideals in terms of the message and the experience that we wanted to offer to guests. And what I found, though, especially with the domestic Japanese guests, were that the people that were coming, that were really paying the bills, that were coming in large groups, that were really my core customer base, so to speak, couldn't really give a shit about any of the eco like, you know, storytelling behind what we were doing. And
what were they there for?
They were there for just, you know, like a big, nice kominka that they could rent and have a party or you know, get wasted and do a barbecue and go play in the river. And it's very typical. Like everybody who comes in the summer, they want to barbecue, they want to do hanabi, and they want to go to the river. And so in the beginning, when we started the rental, we were like, man, there's so much more out here. There's so much culture. There's so much, you know, like more of a deep experience that you could have when you come out here. And we kept trying to kind of like push our customers in that direction. But it was like, you know, forcing the camel to drink from the well when they don't want to, kind of, you know, it seemed like a losing battle. That being said, we did get, you know, we continue to get individuals that really resonate with what we're doing and are really interested in it and really appreciate the storytelling and appreciate the values that we're trying to communicate in what we're doing. But it gives us pause to think, like, okay, if we're in this for the money, it's one thing if it's our lifestyle and we're just sharing our lifestyle as, you know, an extension of, you know, our values and everything. It's another thing if we're doing this as a business and a money-making endeavor. And if that's the case, then maybe there's a different market that we should be targeting with what we're doing. Because the numbers, I mean, ultimately, big groups of Japanese people pay a lot more than individual foreign travelers who are really looking for a deep, authentic experience in the Japanese countryside, unless we're targeting very wealthy individuals, you know? So we're kind of being forced to reanalyze our market and the direction we want to take it in the future.
That's really interesting. You know, and I'd love to dig in with you offline with that. That's a really interesting point of view. But is it that storytelling, is that a way for you to actually leverage assistance from, say, the local Hokkenjo, from the local government office to say, oh, this is what we're trying to show in the area. Please give me money or please give me support. And then, you know, then if the guests show up and they're only interested in, you know, like barbecuing in the garden, then that's fine. But, you know, I'm just looking at how you can leverage that that story.
Yeah, I think there is opportunity to do that. What I'd like to do. So just a little additional background. The plan with this house that's under construction right now is that we're trying to finish it by the end of this year. And, you know, prior to COVID and the border restrictions, you know, we operate an organic farm and we constantly have volunteers that are here on the farm, not only helping with the agriculture, but also helping with the natural building projects and the renovation stuff that we've been doing over the years. However, that source of labor, as it were, has been completely cut off over the last 3 years for myself. And so, you know, what was supposed to be finished 2-3 years ago has now, you know, taken much longer because it's basically been me by myself, completely overwhelmed, trying to manage numerous other things on the side, you know, having a third kid, all that stuff. While trying to finish this massive house that I've bit off more than I can chew, you know.
Yes. So they're woofers. Are they woofers that you've been using?
That's right.
And there's no Japanese woofing that doesn't really much of an appetite for Japanese local?
The level of commitment is different in the sense that Japanese are coming for like a day or a weekend at most to do. They have rent that they're paying somewhere, you know, they live here and they're just when it's you know, convenient for them. Whereas the foreigners who are coming are committing for like, you know, a month or 3 months. Yeah. Time and it's they're here every day, and the learning curve, by the time that's worn off, you know, then we're really productive and we build a good rapport and a good team. So it's a really different experience. And you know, for me, that's been the main motivation with this experience to keep going, that, you know, it's just sharing that with other people has been kind of what's kept me along all this time. And yeah, we're at the end of the line here, thankfully. You know, we're very close to finishing it. And in the interim, though, we've been living at the guest house. And so trying to manage a guest house while living at the guest house with a family, you can imagine what a nightmare that is. When you're trying to, you know, you want to maximize your potential income and you want to promote it and get people in, but you also, you know, are living your life and you need to kind of like strike that balance. So our plan is, as soon as the house is complete, we get out of the guest house, and then we kind of rebrand and reanalyze where we want to take it, and then really focus on trying to promote it more. Because, you know, honestly, we haven't been that proactive in how we market ourselves. Despite that, we've still been able to make good income with it over the years.
Well, how long has it taken you, this entire project? I mean, from the moment you had the idea and moved out there to now that you're near completion.
We renovated the Kominka 5 years ago. And the first couple of years was still before the Airbnb laws had been changed. So we didn't have a license when we first started. And then we also started the house build here around that same time. And obviously it's hard to do two projects at once. And so the renovation of the Kominka was done first. And then we regrouped and put our resources towards working on this house. And then since that, I've worked on a couple of other projects, like building a tiny house using natural materials here locally, which my wife is using as an office. And we're kind of exploring the idea of if there's a market for that kind of product here in Japan, you know, for some kind of like locally sourced materials and natural materials, building a tiny house or a tiny office type space with that. And then the other thing that I'm looking to do in the next year is invest in some real estate here locally with a partner. We're looking to potentially buy some old, or maybe not too old, maybe, you know, 30, 40 year old houses, and then renovate them using natural materials and to kind of build a brand and, you know, kind of build some passive income through real estate in this local area. Because Fujino, it's a unique market, you know, like it's the countryside, but it's so close to Tokyo, and over 50% of the population is people who've moved here. And there's a lot of alternative people living here. So it's got a lot of demand in terms of the property, I'm sure.
Matt, and what, it's like an hour on the express. It's like an hour outside of Shinjuku, right?
It's 1 hour by car to central Tokyo.
Yeah, so we tend to refer to that as like convenient Inaka. And there's a massive artist community, as you mentioned, creative-wise. In fact, I mean, it even has a history as like, I don't know if outcast is the right word, but like the weirdos of the creative side of things tend towards the Fujino area, amongst a few others.
Yeah, there's a lot of creative people. There's a lot of people interested in sustainability and permaculture.
And isn't it the home of like the first permaculture center in Japan?
It was the first transition town in Japan. It's okay. The home of the permaculture center here in Japan. And there's a Steiner or a Waldorf school here. So that's one of the big draws for working Tokyo families who are looking to relocate here and either buy or build a house in the area. So the real estate demand is very high and the supply is relatively low in the area. So I feel like it's a good market to be for myself.
Especially. So when you say property investment, I'm from the investment background here on the panel. So when you say property investment, what sort of investments are you thinking of? I mean, obviously, in those areas, you're probably not buying for capital increase in value or anything of that sort. So what, you'd be renting them out short term, or
buying properties and then renovating using the local craftsmen? And I mean, I've now built up the knowledge base and the network to be able to kind of really cost effectively do this kind of work, at least manage the construction and contracting side of it. And then the end game is either to flip the properties and sell them
as holiday homes
or well, no. As I said, the Steiner School, every year there's like 20 families that move here from Tokyo that want to send their kids to school here. So it's a huge draw, and there's a big lack of decent housing options.
Yeah, we've worked out there with a few clients, and the stock is, at least the good stock anyway, is relatively low. So what Byron's talking about is
so actually definitely a family home flipping kind of thing, like renovating and flipping them.
Flipping, renovating and flipping family homes and either selling them or holding and renting them and then just taking it from there. At least that's what I'm thinking as soon as this house is finished.
I have a question, Byron. Tracy here again. How every shiakusho, hokenjo, has their differences in how you work with them. Have you found the local Hokkenjo to be helpful for what you're trying to do? Have they provided you resources? Have they provided you with, like, you know, fast tracking to get your licenses done?
No.
Don't be polite.
Don't be polite. Be honest. I mean, if someone is looking at going and investing in, you know, different areas, they've got to know that the regulations are really done on a local basis. So I'm always curious to know how friendly they are.
I think that Fujino in particular, because of the merger with Sagamihara City, the seat of government is in Sagamihara, which is a world away from the kind of needs of residents of Fujino. It's a very, very different lifestyle. But, you know, all the bureaucrats that manage this area are, you know, their mind and their incentives and their kind of their thinking is kind of in a different environment, so to speak. And so what I've found in my experience is that if you go to very remote localities, you know, like you go up to Nagano or you go to Yamagata or, you know, Tohoku or somewhere where very far away from Tokyo, the localities tend to be a lot more, they have a lot more incentive to really kind of, you know, get people in and people who are trying to start things. And the Akiya Kominka banks are a lot more active. And Fujino is...
Yep.
You know, close to the city, the priorities of the bureaucrats is more about, you know, how do we get like big businesses and companies in so they can build like a factory in Sagamihara, not like how do we support like farmers and entrepreneurs in Fujino, which is kind of like an afterthought. And so they're more than happy to come and, you know, showcase Fujino when they feel like it'll help them promote Sagamihara city in general. Like, hey, look what Sagamihara can offer. You know, there's all these hippie people out here doing this crap in the countryside. So when there's an opportunity for that kind of thing, they're more than happy to come out and schmooze with you. But I haven't found the bureaucrats to be very proactive or helpful in terms of trying to get done the things that need to be done in order to make my life easier out here doing what I'm doing.
That's unfortunate. I mean, there are some places that, you know, especially remote places, you know, if you say that you're going to be starting up a guest house and trying to be bringing people here, often you get, you know, like a dedicated liaison within the office. But, you know, there are other places that just don't see it, that just don't care.
We've found that there's basically an inverse correlation between proximity to the city, major city centers, and the quality of Akiya banks and municipal assistance programs. The further away you get from big cities, the more help you can expect to find, basically.
And as a side note, I've found, you know, over the years, I initially did work closely with not Sagamihara, but when we were renovating the guest house, which is in technically Yamanashi, I worked with the local Yamanashi government, and they were very proactive in terms of trying to assist in any way that they could in terms of me, you know, trying to get the house renovated and then promoting it after I finished. Do you know in Japanese, I think it's called the Kyoryokutai? They're hired by the local municipalities, and oftentimes they're not local people, but people from Tokyo that have work experience in the private sector. And then they're hired maybe as like a Kominka Iju liaison to help people who are trying to relocate to the area. Man, maybe it was just my isolated experience that I had with this guy, but it turned out to be more trouble than it was worth, because the guy just, you know, he was from Tokyo and he was looking at it the same way that I was looking at it, in a very like, you know, proactive kind of Tokyo type of big city mentality. But he wound up destroying a lot of relationships with local people who are like, this guy, look at this guy from the city. He's coming and, you know, thinks he knows what's up and telling us, you know, this and that. And so his involvement in my project, in a sense, kind of set me back, you know, when we were first starting out. And I was like, man, this is just a time suck, you know, working with the local bureaucrats, because in the end, he's not a local Inaka person, at least in the area where I was. It was like, you know, so he, it was a question of like, who could build more trust and rapport with the locals, myself as a foreigner, or this guy who didn't even have the foreigner appeal, you know?
That was going to be my next question, actually. How, what we often experience deep-seated, let's call it, aversion to foreigners in these countryside locations, like, you know, you guys coming in here to buy your fancy holiday homes and rent the place out to your Airbnb buddies. We don't want you here. Have you run across any sort of resistance like that?
I mean, initially in the village where we renovated the guest house, you know, we opened up a big forum at the local town meeting of the village, you know, and we listened to all the locals' concerns. And I gave a little spiel about what our intentions were and what the plan with the guest house was. And it was clear that, you know, a lot of the concerns that people had was mostly about, okay, what are we going to do if there's foreigners who come and cause a problem and we can't communicate with them because they don't speak Japanese? And what eventually happened was all the problems that did arise was caused by Japanese people who just wanted to get into barbecues. And all the foreigners that did show up were all foreigners who were like really deep in Japan, who spoke Japanese and really respected Japanese culture. So ultimately, you know, we haven't really had any big issues, you know, over the course of 4 or 5 years. And of course, me and my family living at the property over the last couple of years has really helped to kind of build relationships with the local people. To the point where now, you know, if we can find another house in the village and build another unit in the same area, maybe we can get some kind of critical mass and build kind of a hub of tourism and agritourism in the area, and hopefully get a bit more local support in the process.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now back to the podcast.
So how are you? Because that's a big project. You've mentioned about 5 years, and I'm guessing not all of it was fully hands-on. But how are you, if it's not too personal, the question, how are you supporting yourself throughout this period?
No, the first renovation was about 1 year. We started the project 5 years ago, but it took about 1 year to renovate the whole project, to renovate the whole house. And my background was in recruitment and consulting. And when we first moved up here, I was kind of supplementing the you know, the projects that we were doing here in our lifestyle with this recruitment and consulting income, working virtually and going to Tokyo from time to time. And then, you know, we were getting cash flow from the Airbnb business in Tokyo, which during the heyday when we first started, I mean, it was, you know, we were making 300-400% of our cost on a unit, you know, when we first started just subletting it and running it as an Airbnb. Man, those days have changed. Right.
I think that any short-term stay person, Airbnb experienced person knows the term heyday, and we all refer to it in the pre-regulation heyday.
The golden years.
I think I had a dozen properties at that time.
Yeah, I had 30, Byron, just so you know.
Yeah, so my friend who kind of got me into it, he had 12 or 13 in Tokyo, and he was lucky enough to be able to leverage that. And you know, I guess it wasn't luck, but rather timing and you know, the initiative. But he was able to then purchase three units in Tokyo, and now he's not Airbnb-ing any of them, but just renting them out to general renters. But yeah, I think, you know, it was that cash flow that helped me renovate the property out here and then get the regulations and everything set up. And I mean, my costs are low, right, compared to the Tokyo market. You know, the rent and expenses and everything on the property is very cheap. And, you know, our pricing structure and, you know, when we rent it out to a big group of 9 or 10 people, you know, it can be, you know, 10, 15 mon for one booking at a time. So, you know, there's definitely value in targeting that that Japanese market that just wants to come and do barbecue, to the extent that we're like, man, maybe we should just operate barbecue sites in the area and forget the whole ecotourism and all our values and you know, and everything.
Embrace the market.
Just come and barbecue all day long. You know,
give us your money.
Yeah, exactly.
You need that balance between sustainability. Like, you know, there's idealism and then you need to be able to sustain it at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. It gives us pause to kind of, you know,
look. Well, but I mean, and I mean, Byron, you know, you're one of, if not the top person, well, yourself and Cody are, I mean, you're about as close to doing like the dream as I can think of. And I've over the years, like, I know a lot of people are trying to do this shit.
Everyone tells me.
You know, and
it's not all it's cracked up to be.
And like, well, I mean, like Emil was saying, look, there's balance. Okay. There's idealism and everybody can be idealistic. And you know what? Unfortunately, you're going to fail if you're an idealist.
Yeah. And I mean, to be fair, like the COVID restrictions, I mean, it gutted us over the last 2-3 years, you know, like the hospitality business in the first year. You know, we were able to get some grants to tide us over in the short term from the Japanese government. But like, you know, it certainly gave us perspective in terms of, you know, our lifestyle and the cash flow that we had and also the market that we were in and the business that we were doing. You know, in the short term, we started operating like a boutique farm and a vegetable service to the Tokyo expat market through Kasamatsu Farms, which is the brand that we have for our organic farm out here. We were growing vegetables and raising free range eggs from chickens out here and then sending it to expats. And to be fair, I mean, selling it at a very good price, but I mean, it's our lifestyle. It's not like a scalable business.
Right.
That the hard way after 2 years of trying to kind of explore it, that, you know, this is not something you do to make money and sustain your lifestyle. It's something to do when you're retired or when you've got another source of income and you're just
right. And that other source of income thing, I think, is again, Emil was kind of talking about with the balance, like introduce the sustainable elements that you can when you can, when it's reasonable, but mm-hmm. also have, you know, passive or active income that's maybe more consumerist focused and whatnot. But at the same time, also be, because I think you guys are, what you guys do is just an outstanding example of what can be accomplished right now, not in an idealistic sense, but in a reasonable and actionable sense, right? And so with regards to potentially, you know, influencing or affecting a critical mass, for lack of a better term, of more people doing something similar to what you guys are up to, which would then kind of raise the social consciousness of the ideas of sustainability and hopefully, you know, in a few years' time, push, you know, the envelope towards more sustainable practices, more generally speaking. I think, like, you guys are an outstanding example of, you know, a shining example, really, of what that can look like.
Are you part of the conversation and community in other countries on the, you know, off the grid or ecotourism or sustainable living as well? Do you find any of the challenges that you've run across, you know, more of them or less of them, or just different in Japan than they are in other countries and other people that are doing similar things in other places?
Well, I think Japan is it's a very small country, right? And land access, at least in my context, I'm not up in Hokkaido or Nagano. And so I've always kind of been frustrated by, you know, the way that land, agricultural land and residential land in the area is parceled. You know, it's into very illogical plots. And
do you still have that weird parcel that's like right in the middle of everything that you can't?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. One plot here and another farm plot there. But then some other dude owns this thin strip down the center of it. And there's just lots of instances like that. If you're looking at it from a permaculture design perspective, it's a design limitation, you know, like you just have to think about how you can design around that in terms of how you build your system. If you're trying to kind of achieve some kind of sustainable lifestyle out here, you know, that land access is the biggest issue that I've found. And it's something that, you know, they say, we're going to hit critical mass. Things are going to change. The laws and regulations are going to change. 5 years, 10 years, they've been saying it, and I'm still waiting for it to happen. So I don't put much stock in waiting for the Japanese government to really be proactive in changing things. But maybe, I mean, slowly behind the scenes, things are hopefully changing, and I'm just not realizing it because I'm
looking. I mean, that's where, for me, you know, it's kind of a blunt force sort of thing. Do what you can with what you got and what you can find. Don't wait for the laws to change because it's going to take time. Obviously, do things within, you know, within the law and whatnot, but just with outside of the box thinking. Because again, if you ask for permission and wait for it to be granted, someday never comes, you know what I mean?
You know, there's so much like romance involved in renting or buying and renovating a house in the Japanese countryside. I mean, it's been so popularized by media, and it's such like a romantic, visceral experience for people. And so I've done that now. I've gotten it out of my system, so to speak, and I've been a lot more pragmatic. And a lot less idealistic in the process. That now going forward, I'm like, okay, if I'm going to invest in a house in the countryside, does it need to be a 150-year-old house? Do I need to be doing like earthen wall construction and natural building techniques if I'm going to be renting it out to people who don't really appreciate it? Those are all really, you know, like valid questions that I ask myself going forward. So I do think that, you know, just to go back to the question about, you know, how do I sustain myself and how do we make ends meet out here, that I think, at least for myself in my own situation, you know, I'm education and providing that kind of farm to table or ecotourism type experience, and then providing some kind of like workshops or education around what I'm doing. Those are all wonderful things and something that, you know, we can offer just by showcasing our lifestyle and what we've done and built here over the years. But I do think that the real estate and that the, you know, like natural building or construction consulting and working with local clients that are looking to do builds and then managing these kind of projects in the area is probably something that's more realistic, for me to put my energy and time into, just in terms of trying to kind of, you know, build that positive cash flow and build, more of a business around what I'm doing out here.
Well, you sound very practical and yet not too bitter about it. So I guess it's it's going in the right direction. You've just had to make some course corrections along the way, kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm trying to keep the bitterness to a minimum.
the Japanese old man, Inaka old man stereotype has not.
But that's a very interesting point that you make about the way the land is structured or divided here. I guess if you had like 5 acres in Montana, your life would have been a lot easier, right?
Exactly. And I constantly question myself out here, like, what am I doing? You know, here I am, you know, stressing out about how, you know, can I get access to like 100 square meters of property that's like a thorn in my side? And like, is that worth it? You know, wouldn't I rather be in a place where I just have 3-4 acres and I don't have to think about, you know, worrying about appeasing the neighbors and bringing sake to somebody so I can smooth over relations and this and that. So, yeah,
I can't. Byron, could you just turn your camera? Like, I just want to have a look at the.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to get some pictures or walkthrough videos if you have them as well.
Yeah, sure. I can go inside the house and just give you a bit of a.
That would be phenomenal. Awesome. Yeah, if you could.
Yeah, we've been talking about it. I want to see it.
Oh, yeah, I'll put you on the spotlight.
There. Oh, I've done that. I've put him on spotlight.
Yeah.
All right, so this is the front of the house alongside the road. You can see the wall constructions. This is my blue healer. His name's Odin.
Louis.
I love blue healers. They're the best.
Yeah. The walls are built using this material called light straw clay. And so you can see the wall cavities. It's about 30... almost 40 centimeters thick, super well insulated. And then what's gonna happen on the exterior here is it's gonna get a thin layer of mud, which is what is fermenting in this thing here. It's just straw and clay that's breaking down the fibers of the straw. And then that's gonna get mixed and applied to the walls.
But is that the cob that we were making last time I was up there?
No, so that stuff that we mixed had sand mixed into it.
Ah, right.
Used for the interior walls, which is like a Japanese earthen wall, traditional material. So
I've seen those in Kyoto projects. They're beautiful. They're so warm.
Bamboo lattice inside the walls. You can see the ceilings are vaulted, and I'm probably going to do some kind of really eclectic like wallpaper in between those roof jousts, almost like a circus tent kind of, you know, you can kind of imagine. It's kind of like a mix aesthetically of traditional Japanese like aesthetic with kind of Western living and lifestyle. So I've got a steel staircase here that's going to be going up to the loft area where we're having a railing put in here by a metal artist. And that's going to be where the children's room is. And then this is going to be like the children's study. The view is really epic. I mean, it's overlooking the mountain. Kanzawa Mountains over there. And then that's the border of Yamanashi and the local onsen you can see in the mountains in the distance.
No power cables. I love it.
Yeah. Nothing. This is going to be kind of like the family living room. And then I've got this bamboo feature that I made here in the wall.
Nice.
Round circled window. And then this is what the walls are going to look like once they've been gotten the second layer of plaster over it. So I have a friend who's he's a professional plasterer, and he came a couple of weeks ago and we did a few of these walls. But this is also clay and earth, just a finer mix compared to what the rough walls are made of. Here you can see.
You rendered that yourself, right? Like you made the clay sort of mix and you just sort of render it on?
No, so the walls themselves are made using like a bamboo lattice that's attached inside. Let me see if there's a good example. Here you can kind of see on the wall, do you see like there's slightly discolored horizontal strips, right? So because it's traditional Japanese construction, it doesn't have diagonal supports inside the wall. It's held by these lateral strips of wood that are then wedged into the posts and then held in place by wooden wedges. Those are called nuki in Japanese. And so a nuki is a bamboo lattice, and then the mud mix is mixed and then applied to that bamboo lattice. So the walls themselves are probably, you've got the lattice in the middle, and then maybe 3 or 4 centimeters on this side of the lattice. So it's about, you know, 6 to 8 centimeters thick, the walls themselves inside the house.
Okay. But the actual surface, the finished surface of the wall is actually that rendered.
No, so this clay layer, and then of that, it gets this material, which is it's also earth and plaster, but it's a finer mix that's been somewhat professionally applied. So the finish is a lot cleaner and nicer, and it has the same vapor permeability aspects of natural materials, okay, with plywood, something like that. This is going to be the bathroom and shower. It's Western style with like a shower room, and I'm going to have a toilet in the same room and a sink and a big mirror on the wall here. This is going to get FRP waterproofing in the next week or so, and then we're probably going to tile the whole room, doing like either some kind of Moroccan tile type thing or subway tiles. And then this is going to be where this is the main staircase of the house to go downstairs. So you come in on the mezzanine floor, and then the first floor is kind of the living area. The second floor is mostly bedrooms. And then the only tatami room in the house is going to be here in the center. I have this wild log here where the stairs are wedged into this massive momiji log. This is a maple log. And then this is going to be the one tatami room, some nice details on the ceiling that we've done. And these walls have already gotten the finished plastering. A lot of the wood and the timber that you see, like these keyaki beams and these big beams on the top, those are all things that I've cut down or I've bought directly from lumberjacks in the area. And then these big beams, these are like 10 meter long logs, and they it's like one piece basically that goes across the whole top. And I've got like 13 or 14 of those making up the whole frame of the first floor and the third floor.
So Byron, just to clarify, this is not something that you've purchased, traditional home that you're renovating. This is all built from scratch, isn't it?
From scratch and hand hewn. And I had a local master carpenter who had done all the simitsuke, like he was marking out the posts and the beams where the mortises and the tenons were going to go. And then me.
Has he gone quiet?
I think we've lost him.
Oh, we've lost him. Oh, no. Okay, we've lost
him. What an amazing... wow, what an amazing place.
Oh, you have no idea.
I didn't know to expect, but wow.
This is good, but like actually getting there is a whole other level. Like, it's crazy. I mean, the farm is right below. He hasn't shown you that. They've got a pizza oven right outside. There's a whole other kind of house sort of thing, like campsite on the other side of the road. It's like I said before we started recording, like if 7-year-old me saw this, I would just be going absolutely apeshit over it.
Yeah. How far is it from the Echo Lodge?
It's probably like, it's like 10 or 15 minutes. Driving, not walking.
Okay.
Right. I can send the addresses and stuff, or maybe I already did, but I can resend.
Well, I mean,
them.
Obviously, we want to link to his, like, and I was going to ask him if he had a private booking site as well as the Airbnb. So, but I mean, you know, once he's getting this up and running, actually marketing it is almost like a full time job as well. Like, you know, and
he
seems to have two full time jobs already, building the house and doing that and growing the vegetables. So
he's got three kids. Like, I mean, I've got three.
I'm
like,
kids, right?
I barely find time to you know, shave my head.
Let alone work out you, Emil. Like, yeah. I only have one. I have no excuse. So.
Well, we seem to have lost him, and no, hang on, he's coming back. He just saw me.
In the waiting room?
He's not in the waiting room yet. Mm. That's amazing.
Yeah, I highly suggest going up and staying at the Eagle Lodge.
I'm looking at it going, I need to take my family up here, because if it's only an hour out of, you know, if it's only an hour's drive.
Oh, he's back. He's back.
There he is.
Sorry about that.
We got to your, you had a master carpenter who was doing something, and that's where we got to.
So the master carpenter had done all the semitske. So he had drawn on the logs where the mortise and tenons were going to be. And
sorry, Tracy, can you put him back on the main screen?
Got there it.
You go. Is that better? Sorry, carry on, Mario.
Yeah, and me and the volunteers had done all the shaping and chiseling to do all the traditional joinery everywhere on the ceiling. And then, so this sunroom is going to be connected to this dining and living room where I'm standing now. And so the floor is going to be flush here, and there's not going to be a separation. So this is like an extension of the living room. We're going to put glazing in between here. And then I have this nice metal planter that I had custom made here, and that's going to get filled with soil. So the idea is to have like a little kitchen herb garden growing inside this greenhouse, which is attached to the south side of the structure, and then use that to passively heat the space in the wintertime.
That's amazing.
And then just the final, this is going to be the kitchen and main. I'm going to have probably like a nice slab out here, counter, and like an island in the center, and then tiling on this wall here. And then back here, there's just another smaller washroom and toilet. And I have this lots of kind of like basement storage space down here where we've done
amazing. A lot of concrete and we're work. Now in we're recording this in September, and you said that you'll be done by the end of the year, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm at the point now where I'm so past DIY that I just want to hire enough people to get done. And you know,
get in here and finish this.
it looks like there's still a lot to do, but there's actually you know, most of the work is definitely behind us. And it's good to be kind of on the final stretch here. I'll just walk and kind of give you a shot of it. I did the tile roofing on the roof myself as well, the kawara on the roof. And man, that was a learning curve as well.
This is amazing work that you've done.
Incredible.
Yeah. So
would you do it again?
No, I wouldn't.
Good question, Emil.
That's why he said consulting. He's going to support other people as they do it.
Exactly. Have you thought of getting some interns? Some interns, because you can get them in on a, like, there are agencies that, because there's a ton of people who want to come to Japan. Mm. And if you've got a job for them as an intern, because you've got place to put them up, you could grab yourself some willing workers. If they're not wolfing, they can be interns for you.
Yeah. Actually, in September, there's two Dutch guys that are coming on an internship.
Beauty. Oh, already ahead of me.
one had come on an internship 3 years ago before COVID and was planning on coming back, but then things got put on hold for 2-3 years because of the visa restrictions. He's finally going to be able to come in September. And then there's another Dutch student that's going to be coming, getting like university credit.
What's woofing?
That is on the exterior of the house.
Woofing is farm experience. You get a visa to go and volunteer on a farm.
I don't believe you get a visa. It stands for Willing Workers on Organic Farms, WWOOF. I'm a woofer, or I used to be anyway.
I used to be a woofer. So it's a worldwide thing, Emil. It's not just Japan. So. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I haven't heard that before.
The last thing I would add is that on the exterior here, we're going to put wooden siding probably where these horizontal strips of wood are. And then you can see the bit just in the below the top windows there, how there's like an angle. We're probably going to finish just below the eaves of the house with natural plaster. But the horizontal siding will go onto those wooden strips there. And there's just a layer of earth in between there. So that's about the extent of the, I have some other details and other crazy things that I want to do with the exterior here. But maybe that's for another time.
That's amazing.
How do you move those logs, Byron? They are massive and they are heavy.
Yeah, we've done some crazy stuff, man. When I look back on it, you know, a lot of the rocks that we used were from Mount Fuji. And I remember driving up to Mount Fuji, getting the Fujisan Yogan, loading them into the back of a 4-ton truck, and then driving like 5 or 6 loads of them over here where we, you know, I think about the physical human energy and just the mass of the, you know, all the earth and the clay and how many tons of material go into building a house of scale. And it's just kind of awe-inspiring. And it's no wonder why people don't houses like this anymore.
It's entirely too much work.
And, you know, when I first started, I was talking with, you know, I talked to so many carpenters and so many builders and architects, trying to find someone who would come with me on this journey, trying to build this house the way I wanted it. And, you know, everybody I talked to was like, ah, no, it's not possible. No way. You know, like tradies and carpenters, they don't want to work on a job that's going to take 5 years. You know, they want to get in and get out and get on to the next thing. And so I finally found this guy who was willing to help. And it's very hard to find craftsmen to work with you on something like this.
Well, you've done amazing work, man. We really appreciate you showing us around, but also all of the conversation leading into that. I think this would be really eye-opening for a lot of people who have been asking questions about this. I know that we regularly, and Matt knows this very well, we regularly get asked questions about buying these old places in the countryside, and even the work involved in bringing an existing place up to speed tends to turn people off after they actually realize what's involved. So you're talking about doing everything from scratch. It's remarkable what you've done there.
I certainly wouldn't do it again. And, you know, when I started this process, by the way, this is the tiny house that I built for my wife that she's using as her office.
That's adorable.
Built with all natural materials. It's got the chicken coop running right in front of it. Chickens are running.
Is that yakisugi?
Yakisugi on the exterior, and it's sitting on like a steel frame. So the idea was I wanted something that could be picked up and put on the back of a truck and then drop like a parking space, maybe in like a more urban environment. And this was just kind of like a beta version to see, you know, what could be done with those kind of limitations. And so it's off grid. It's got solar panels on the roof, and it's got all the conveniences. It's super insulated. It's got like a cedar ceiling, Japanese cedar bark ceiling, and you know, nice natural flooring and earthen plaster on the walls. A nice desk here. Not 100% finished, but it's a nice little model on the farm. And so my thoughts were, how could I potentially market this as a small business, but I'm not sure that maybe this is the market here in Japan. People just don't have a lot of land where, I mean, the people that have land out in the countryside, there's just so many empty houses out here that, you know, why would you need to drop a tiny house like this? And then everybody that wants a tiny house office doesn't have the space in central Tokyo to put something like this down anyway. So there might be a market, but it just needs to be kind of thought through more.
I have seen, Byron, one thing similar to that. It's these for the work from home cubicle you kind of put in your driveway.
Yes.
Exactly.
Which is what you said just sort of reminds me of. And I think I just read one article on it.
Yeah, there's that, and then there's the really depressing like central Tokyo station, like subway cubicles.
The pods.
Which are just
coffins.
They look like suicide tanks to me.
Well, you know, thank you very much for coming on, Ben. We really appreciate it. We're probably at the end of our time, but if people want to reach out to you to support or to protect, you mentioned organic farm supplies as well. What other businesses, websites? I mean, send me the links later, but what should people be looking at to get in touch with you?
Yeah. We have both on Facebook. And, you know, we have the farm website. The guest house is Yokomura Eco Lodge, and that's available through Airbnb. And we also have a standalone website for that that's linked with the farm. The farm is kasamatsufarms.com. And you're able to contact me through there. And as I said, if people are looking in to doing kind of natural building projects and looking for someone to help, I'm more than happy to try to you know, share my wealth of experience and perspective. So
credentials are splattered all over this video. Thank you for that.
I'm really, Byron, I'm really keen to come out and bring my family out and stay in that lodge. It looks amazing. And have a barbecue.
Tracy, I'm thinking the same thing. Oh, I mean, you know, some other families, I could just imagine us going up there. Let's go for a barbecue.
Do it.
Straight up on people come just for groups for the barbecue.
Meet up. That's exactly. Awesome.
Well, yeah. Weren't y'all talking about doing some kind of convention or whatnot anyway?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah,
We are talking about doing it, and we need to talk to Emil about that. But I think it's big enough to do, you know, 16 guests, three. I'm looking at your Airbnb site now. But I thought the price was too cheap, and then I started putting up the number of guests, and I went, oh, good one, well done. Yes. So I'm like, because I help people with their pricing strategies on Airbnb, and I'm like, oh man, you're too cheap. Oh, okay. Now we're talking. So yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, good for you.
Well, thank you very much for your time today, Byron.
And, thank you, Byron.
We'd love to have you on again, either in person when we do an a face-to-face seminar in Tokyo or here again.
Happy to come.
Give us some
when
updates.
When you're finished would be on a day when the finished product is ready.
We'll do the tour then again, yeah, after the house is complete.
Love it.
Yes, please. Well, thank you everyone for your time. And we'll see you again next time.
Yeah, and I'll see you Saturday, Byron.
Yeah, looking forward to it, man. We'll put you to work.
Likewise.
Yeah, please do. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
There you have it. Truly remarkable work. Would he do it again? Hell no. But don't let that discourage you, folks. If you've got, like many of our viewers who regularly tell us about, if you've got a dream of sustainable off-the-grid living in the Japanese countryside, Byron and his family are living proof that the dream can come true. But be prepared for some seriously hard work along the way. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa, and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you.